You're listening to Juno Afternoon. Thank you for being with us here today. I'm Rhonda McBride. Last night at a rally for Orange Shirt Day at Sandy Beach, a Tlingit dance group performed a song inspired by loons and their calls back and forth across the water. The song belongs to the Raven Dog Salmon people of the Cake Territory. Lyle James says his grandfather composed it, inspired by the calls of the loon, which he says are like echoes of past generations reaching out across time. Reaching out across time, ancient echoes. That has been the case for an exhibit at the State Museum, The Spirit Wraps Around You, which opened in May. Perhaps this song is an important way to begin our next conversation. Voices from the past speaking to us through blankets and weavings from peoples of the North Coast. And joining us now, Steve Henriksen, he's curator of collections at the State Museum, and Mary Lou Jerby, who has been working on a beautiful book about this collection. And later in our program, we hope that Lanny Hotch will be able to join us. She is one of the exhibition curators and comes from one of the leading families in Klukwan, leading weaving families, and she's also a professional weaver and heads the Chilkat Heritage Center there. We're hoping to hear from her, but in the meantime, we'll begin with Steve Henriksen. Steve, this collection is soon to disappear. It seems like you had this wonderful family reunion put together, and it's just too short.
Yeah, it is sad to see it go. Thank you for having us on. And we are getting into the last week of the exhibit. And we just wanted to remind folks, if they hadn't gotten out to see it yet, it's really one of the most extensive and expensive exhibits that we've done here in the last few decades. And it really is a rare opportunity to learn about the history of something that a lot of us kind of grew up with, knowing about Chilkat robes and seeing dancers wearing them. But the exhibit also looks at an earlier form of weaving that predates Chilkat, which is called today, it's the Yaeth Kuwu tail feathers of the raven, or raven's tail weaving. It's an earlier form that was lost for quite a while until about 30 years ago, when weavers of today resurrected the technique, and we have a exhibit hall filled with both old and new robes for another week or so until the last day of the show is October 9th.
So why so short? A lot of people are thinking, you know, you work 30 years to get this here, apparently, and in just a few months, it's over.
Yeah, that's the nature of doing temporary exhibits. We usually have at least a dozen or more exhibits cycling through every year. And this one, it's such a complicated and expensive one. It took us, you know, really the first idea to have it was 30 years ago. We really got serious about it a couple of years ago, and it took a lot of fundraising. The people of this community and of Southeast Alaska really saved us by being so generous with their cash donations to help pay for the expenses of the show, which were quite significant. The bulk of the cost of the show was to get two ancient robes here from the East Coast, and that was over $30,000 to get those here, and that was all gifted money through our friends group, the Friends of the State Library, Archives, and Museums.
So amazing. What has been the impact of people seeing the two older blankets?
Yeah, that was really 30 years ago when this idea first came up. The contemporary weavers were relearning this technique, this raven's tail technique, based on a dozen original ones that survived mostly in European museums. And a lot of the weavers here had never actually seen one of these few surviving originals. And the idea came up, well, let's get one of them here. And it turned out that, you know, most of these are in pretty inaccessible places. St. Petersburg, Russia has four, and the British Museum has one. And the cost of getting them here and the, we tried to get the one from the British Museum that was collected by Captain James Cook on his third expedition in 1778. And that we didn't have a cargo aircraft flying to Juneau that was big enough for that shipping container. So we had to go to Toronto to get the one that we ultimately got. And that is a really significant one, very beautiful, but a little less logistical trouble to get here. Even that said, we still had to get the U.S. State Department to declare that it was in the national interest for that robe to travel into the United States. And we had to get a whole folder of permits to bring it across the border because it has sea otter fur on it. And sea otter is a protected species under international law. So it was really, for me, a legal education to be able to get this robe in our building. And it's it really is an incredible sight to actually see it here next to all of these new robes that have been woven based on the lessons that robe has to teach us. The weavers consider those few old robes to be their teachers.
Mary Lou Jerby, who is also here with us, has been working on sort of a catalog of the collection and working with the weavers to put together sort of, I would call it a coffee table book almost, to be enjoyed long after this exhibit is gone. What was the thinking behind that project?
Well, Rhonda, it's amazing to be able to enjoy this after it does leave. Like you said, it seems like it's such a short time. It's been there all summer, the exhibit has. But now, I mean, you want to be able to read about it and learn. And many of the things that they've said that Steve knows and the other weavers know will be captured in this book. It's a beautiful 96-page full-color book with all of the robes plus others and pictures of people. It really is a catalog book. I mean, a beautiful coffee table book, as you said, and it will be, it's going to be available even after the show leaves October 9th. So you'll be able to get it through the Friends of the State Library, Archives and Museum. We have a website, foslam.org, Friends of State Library Archives Museum. So foslam.org/store. And so you can get it there, you can get it at Hearthside, or you can get it at the museum. We've got the little dip jar, and you just pop in your credit card and boop, you've got a book and you're done, $40. And I think the good thing, this is going to be a beautiful book for Christmas gifts or for gifts to friends, anyone who's interested in art.
Well, it seems to me if you've already been to the exhibit, it would be good to have that book in hand and revisit the exhibit, because the book has so many stories about these blankets and all the amazing things that are in the backdrop, like how the dyes are created. And I imagine, Steve, that this exhibit has been more than just an exhibit. It's been sort of this work in progress, this journey of discovery about the blankets themselves.
Yeah, very much so. And that's true for me as a curator, but also for the weavers who were involved in this exhibit and in bringing back raven's tail weaving. It's really been part of their lives. And so the catalog really goes into much greater depth than the exhibit can do, given we have very short labels in the show. We don't expect people to stand around for hours in the show reading labels. This is a more convenient way to digest the information, but we are really encouraging people to actually come and see this show while it's here, because it's one of, for me, and I've been to hundreds probably of exhibits here over the years. For me, this is one of the most special exhibits because of the feel that you get when you enter that space and you feel that spirit. That's what the elders that have come here, they've said, you know, the spirit is powerful in this room, and that's because these are sacred objects. They're works of art, yes, but they're also sacred objects, and there is that power. You feel that power when you come into the room, and the beauty of the robes as well is something not to be missed. So I really hope that people can see it before it leaves. Now, luckily, most of these robes actually live here in Southeast. I would say 95% of the robes in the show have been borrowed from local clans or owners. And we have, the museum has 5 or 6 robes from our own collection in the show as well. So most of these stay here. It's just there's a couple of the contemporary robes that have to be returned to out-of-state owners, and then these two ancient robes. There is also the other expensive museum loan that we got for the show is the oldest documented Chilkat robe in existence, which also happens to be, by all accounts, the finest Chilkat robe as far as the weaving. And it is really spectacular. You can just sort of, when you stand in front of that case, it's like you're standing in front of a black hole, and you can just feel it drawing you in. It is indescribable. So I really encourage people to experience it firsthand. And it's very rarely travels out of Salem, Massachusetts, where it lives. And so it's a once in a lifetime chance for people to see this where it was woven too. I mean, we don't know exactly where, but in the vicinity of Juneau was where this was woven in the early 1800s.
Where did the title for the exhibit come from? Spirit wraps around you.
Yeah. Well, it came from, it comes from the Tsimshian word for the dancing robes, which translates as the spirit wraps around you, which is a very great description of what happens when you put that robe on. You are literally wrapping the spirit world around you. The spirits of the ancestors hover around that robe, and they interact with living people and influence current events and are helping spirits. They're positive spirits. And so one of the functions of these robes in their cultural context is for healing purposes. When they come out at the potlatches, where it's a memorial feast that ends the events that surround a funeral. And it's they are brought out, and they are there to help the grieving family. They are displayed. Other clans will bring their finery out and say, you know, this robe is like a handkerchief to catch your tears. So it has this deep meaning, and we're really, really fortunate to have had such a positive reaction to this exhibit from the clans that we've worked with, who have had to live without their robes for a while. And part of their agreement with us to borrow them is that if it's needed for ceremonial purposes, it comes out of the exhibit and we just don't have it there. And we think that having an empty display is the best artifact ever to show that these are living objects.
Well, unfortunately, we had hoped that Lanny Hotch, one of the weavers who helped you put this exhibit together would join us today. Maybe we can have her back at some point in the future. But when the exhibit opened, I had a little chat with her, and she showed me this copper design. I mean, this wooden design board of a design known as Coppers, I guess. And she said that had been in her family for generations, and one of the older blankets that came had that design. So she figures that was probably one of her ancestors. So this blanket comes back to her. I mean, there were probably many discoveries like that during this exhibit. What were some of the aha moments for you and for some of the weavers?
Well, I think we're interested in the exhibit explores the history of the weaving, starting with basketry and robes woven out of cedar bark, and these were probably the earliest types of garments woven here. It was just a plain cedar bark robe, and how that then transitioned into raven's tail weaving that uses mountain goat wool instead of cedar bark and has geometric patterns like baskets. And then there was another leap in technology that allowed for Chilkat weaving to be perfected, which gets out of the geometric patterns and it starts reproducing curved clan crest designs in the weaving. It's a really unusual thing as a weaving technology. Usually you're using warps and wefts, and warps go up and down, wefts go across, and they cross each other at a 90-degree angle. And when you're doing a pattern with that, you're sort of locked into a geometric design. But Chilkat weaving has figured out a way to make true curves in using this warps and wefts, and it allows for clan crest designs to be reproduced. So one of the aha moments is looking in the early raven's tail robe and seeing the beginnings of Chilkat weaving, where they're just starting to change things up, to experiment, and try to figure out a way to make curved designs. And you can see in the raven's tail robe we have, there's hints of Chilkat in the early Chilkat robe with the coppers on it. That has little hints of raven's tail. So that was like right when it was changing. So we can see this in the artifacts we selected. You can see this technological leap.
So what does the term coppers refer to? Was that some kind of a shield made out of copper, some kind of an implement?
Well, the origins of it are somewhat obscure, but, a copper, also called a tana in Tlingit and a tau in Haida, is a symbol of wealth. It's made out of copper, a sheet of copper in a certain shape. And early on, copper was one of the only sources of metal, and so it had great value. It was traded in from the Copper River and possibly other places. So it was very a status symbol, and a copper shield was a symbol of wealth, even though it wasn't not really a shield for defensive purposes. And this robe that we have here, the oldest documented one, has that symbol of a copper, of two coppers actually woven in, and it's a clan crest, and may represent a story about the origins of a specific clan, even though we don't know which one it is with certainty.
And that's the robe that has connections for Lanny Hotch's family.
Yeah, that's right. That was collected in the 1830s in California. And we don't know how it got down there. Obviously, it came from Southeast Alaska. A trader picked it up and sold it to the Russians down in California. And then another American trader purchased it from them. So we don't know exactly where it came from in Southeast Alaska. But the fact that Lonnie found the pattern border, it's a very similar design. And that is a very rare pattern. This is the only known robe to have that exact pattern on it. So I think the chances are good that that's where it came from.
Mary Lou, I know your job has been to put together this catalog, and that name doesn't do it justice because it's so beautiful. But in putting this together, you must have had a lot of contact with the weavers. What did you distill from that?
Well, I have to admit that I am not the one. Steve is actually the one who put that catalog together. I'm just representing the friends and trying to get word out there that we do have this catalog. So I have to defer to Steve, who is our expert here. And I'm happy to do that because I love listening to his stories as well.
Well, when you look at that catalog and read through some of these stories, what strikes you?
Oh, the beauty of these. And I guess, as Steve said, the spiritual feeling you get from these robes. I walked with Cancer Connection, and one of the things that I have to say, it really brought me to tears. George Riefenstein is a friend, and he's been going through cancer. He was told by his host father, who is a Tlingit, that he should think of himself as being wrapped in the spirit of the Chilkat robe, and that will heal him. And that really came to life when I saw the catalog. I just, oh my gosh, this really is true. You know, I'm not Tlingit, but I still feel that wonderful, amazing feeling of being captured by the spirit of this culture. And so I loved, it's just a beautiful art.
Well, one of the things, because of the spiritual nature of these robes, they couldn't be treated like objects. And so they were brought to the museum in a special way, and I presume that they're going to leave the museum in a special way. Steve, what are the plans for this farewell that we really don't want to have with these blankets?
Yeah, well, we're still making those plans as we speak, but what we intend to do is, before we take the robes off their displays, where there'll be some Tlingit clan members coming in to sing to the robes, because they're going to be put away for a time. And at some later time, many of them will be coming out again. There are several that are too fragile to really use. If you tried to dance with it, there'd be it would be a disaster. But most of them are sturdy enough to still dance. And the clan leaders and members will sing to them, and then selected robes will be danced off exhibit. Our staff will take them off the mounts, and dancers will put them on, and they'll dance back to where we have storage space for them. And from there, they'll be crated and bagged up, and then one by one, they'll leave the museum. But you'll be able to see the same robes again, not all together, but many of these robes will be at celebration next year and at many future ceremonial events. So it's just a farewell, not a final goodbye.
Well, that's good to know, because you never really want to say goodbye to family, right? And it sounds like for many people, especially the weavers, these robes are family.
Yeah, they are family. They're also, so many of the weavers talk about how they consider the robes their teachers, because there's no one left that learned how to weave in the traditional way. There are people that learn from those folks, a few, but most people, they learn from taking classes at the university or reading books or looking at old robes and reverse engineering the technique and figuring out then how to do it. So it's very, very much like family. And for sure, the time that we got to spend with these robes will stick in our minds. And, you know, I have visual pictures of all of them in my brain, and I'm sure the weavers do as well. But every time you do see one in person, you learn new things. It has new lessons to teach us. So we hope to someday be able to see them all again in another place and time.
Well, it seems like these robes, even the way they were displayed as if they were dancing, or to suggest that they were caught in movement. So this just is not a typical exhibit. Would you agree to that? I mean, it's just a beautiful experience, but it's so much more than looking at objects.
Right. It's three-dimensional. It's not stuff on the wall at all. You really feel the movement of the robe, and you just feel captured by it. Yeah.
Yeah, and we wanted really to convey movement in the way that some of the robes are mounted, and having them in three dimensions like that, it turns them into sculpture. It starts out being a two-dimensional work of art. It turns into sculpture. And when you look closely at the woven surface of the robe, it too has depth to it. It's a sculpted piece of weaving. There's higher areas, there's lower areas. So it really, there's a lot going on in there. And that's why being there in person in front of it is really essential. So I highly recommend that you come in and take a good look at it through October 9th is our last day. And I'm going to be giving a walkthroughs in there tomorrow from 2 to 4. And also on the final day, the 9th, Saturday the 9th, from 2 to 4, we'll also have weavers in there working. And so we really hope you can come in.
Well, one other thing we should say before we go, too, is the weaving has been a struggling art, in danger of extinction almost. Do you think that this exhibit will lead to a renaissance in weaving?
That's a good question. That was certainly one of the reasons why we wanted to have it, was to hopefully encourage weavers to learn these techniques. I think it's a tall order, though, due to the difficulty of just getting the materials and learning how to make the materials. You can't just go out to Tandy Leather and order a bunch of Chilcat warp. You have to put it together yourself. And after hundreds of hours of making the material, then you can start weaving. It's really a lifetime commitment to do that. And it's, I think for some time to come, it's going to be an art form that's really practiced by very, very few people. But I do hope that the exhibit, it lights a fire in people to make that commitment. And at least it will broaden awareness of how special this art is and how distinctive it is in the whole world. This is something that's uniquely from Alaska and northern British Columbia. This is where it was developed, and it turned into a master art right where we live today. And that's something that everybody should be very, very proud of.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much, Steve Henriksen, who is curator of collections at the State Museum, and Mary Lou Jerby, who has been working on getting this beautiful book out and available to the public. We were going to have Lanny Hotch with us today. She is a weaver and was involved in putting this collection together, but hopefully we can have Lanny here at a future time to talk about this collection, because she has an amazing legacy that has been passed on to her and has worked hard to in turn pass it on to others. So hopefully maybe Steve, we can have her here on Juno Afternoon at some point.
Yes, I'm sure that'll be possible. I'll help make that happen.
I know this is, I mean, I think it would just be so wonderful to hear how this exhibit has affected people from the weaver's perspective. But Gunnish Cheesh, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. Helen Kim and Jasmine Arakawa do a dance that you can't see, but only hear. Helen on the violin and Jasmine on the piano. This was sound that I recorded at a rehearsal yesterday at the Juno Arts and Culture Center, where they will be performing tonight. We'll talk in a moment, but first, let's listen. What a dance they do, Helen Kim and Jasmine Arakawa, here in town for the Juno Jazz and Classic Fall Festival. And gosh, I hate to disappoint people, but when I looked on the Juno Jazz and Classics website, many of the events are sold out, but I guess there are some workshops. Well, welcome to Juno, and perhaps I should ask each of you maybe what you think your specialty is in your art form. And so let's begin with you, Helen.
Thanks again for having me, Rhonda. It's such a pleasure to be here in beautiful Juneau. I can only imagine how beautiful it would be without the rain. But, your question is a difficult one. That's something I'm actually a professor as well. So I'm a teacher, and that's a question I always ask my students. What do you think is your strength? Because I try to build their confidence, and that's something that I think is always evolving as an artist, is what I think is my strength. I think from an early age, I like to perform. I've always loved that interaction with a live audience. I feed off that excitement. So I guess in a way that would be my strength, because although it's always terrifying to perform in its own way, it's always thrilling. So I welcome that excitement every opportunity I get. So,
how about you, Jasmine?
Hi, Rhonda. Thank you so much for having me as well. Clearly I play the piano, and I love a lot of Latin American and Spanish repertoire. I play a very many standard repertoire as well. But so tonight we're playing a lot of dance movements and all these things that I really enjoy playing.
Well, unfortunately, I don't think there are any tickets left to tonight's concert, but there are some workshops that are coming. But hopefully, maybe you guys will come back to Juno at some point. I want to play a little bit of your piano playing. Maybe you could set this up for us. We recorded a small excerpt from your concert.
Sure. So this is a piece I'm going to perform tomorrow night as part of the Ritz. And this is written by a Brazilian composer, Claudio Santoro. And as I mentioned, that I like dance movements. And this is particularly, it's part of the dance. And this is based on the style of popular Brazilian songs called choros. It's a popular genre, and it's an imitation of that. And it's a beautiful, beautiful thing. And you may not have heard this particular piece, but it feels like you've heard it somewhere. So I hope you enjoy.
I guess I would kind of describe that as ethereal. almost. Why did you choose it for your Juno performances?
I wanted to play something that is a bit different from the standard repertoire. That's one of the things that I've been trying to pursue myself. I've played a lot of standard repertoire, and recently I'm looking into something that I've never played. So I'm also playing African music composition by a Nigerian composer tomorrow. That was completely new to me. And I've played some of the Brazilian music as well, but this is a wonderful set called a Paulistina, and that means the girls from São Paulo. And that portrays a different aspect of ladies in São Paulo, in Brazil. So these are really short characteristic pieces, and I wanted to especially share with the audience in Juno.
It is lovely. Well, let's hear a little more. So, in traveling all the way to Juno, what is the joy for you of coming to places like this and bringing your music? Because one thing that we should probably point out is that the two of you don't always play together, that this is kind of a special thing. Helen, having someone accompany you or working together with someone like Jasmine on the piano, what kind of an experience is that like, just coming together for a special event?
Well, it's chemistry with certain people. It's sometimes you meet someone and you feel like you've been friends before. And Jasmine and I just met in July of this year at the Highlands Chamber Music Festival in North Carolina with Zool. And immediately we read through our music, the first rehearsal, and it felt like we've always played together. It's one of those rare combinations. And that doesn't happen with anyone. So it's a lot of trust. And I'm so thrilled when Zool invited both of us after that to join him in Juno. He could feel that chemistry, I think. And that is just that comfortableness that you are breathing at the same rate in a way. So it's a joy, actually, to get to play with Jasmine. I feel like I've played with her for years and years. So it's wonderful.
So in case people hear some background noise, I think Jasmine is at the Juno Arts and Culture Center where they're setting up for tonight. So you might hear a few things rustling in the background there. But for those people who don't know, Zool Bailey is a well-known cello player, famous across the world. And he is also the artistic director of the Juno Jazz and Classics Festival, which he recently took over from Linda Rosenthal, who founded it with some others in Juno. But you have a special connection to Zool Bailey, Helen. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. I'm one of the lucky people that I knew Zool when we were in school together at Juilliard back in the 1900s, as he likes to say. And we got to play in a chamber music group. So we got to work together closely more than normally, because normally we would just interact in classes, but we actually performed together and worked together for a year. And from the first time we met, we were friends. And that conversation continued in our playing and when we're not rehearsing. And then life happened and we didn't see each other for about over 20 years. And in 2016, we were reunited at another music festival in North Carolina. And by then he had won his Grammys and he's traveling the entire world. And so I actually didn't expect him to remember me. I was just thrilled I was going to get a chance to reconnect and play with him again because it had been such a joy. But he walked in, he's like, Helen, how have you been? It was like not a second had gone by and we picked up right where we left off. And he's just an amazing person, I think. I was speaking to you yesterday about him. I think all the qualities that were his strengths as a student. He was always a leader, always an incredible musician, but also just a really great person, just someone you wanted to be around and just honest and hardworking. And all those traits, I think, have only strengthened. So it's kind of amazing to reconnect after all that time as friends and as collaborators on stage.
Well, one of the things that he wanted to do in kind of expanding the Juneau Jazz and Classics to a fall session was to have time for more outreach in the schools. And of course, you've got some workshops coming up for students and I guess anyone that can sign up and get a space. How is that for a musician of your caliber to be going into the schools?
I think it's absolutely, I agree with Zula. It's our duty kind of as artists to share our music with others. I love going in to meet the local talent. That's one of my favorite things to do. I've always believed that, especially going into the schools where they might not normally get a musician guest. I still remember as a child growing up in Calgary, Alberta, when the local orchestra came in. I thought that was just a few musicians came in, but that kind of got my interest in the arts right away. So I absolutely love that part of my job. I do it a lot when I live in Atlanta, Georgia, and I do a lot of outreach there too. I go up to the Boys and Girls Clubs, really whoever calls and needs someone to come visit, I'm so happy to do. So it's always a joy to do that for me.
So how about you, Jasmine? Do you enjoy the outreach with the students as well?
Absolutely. And for me, especially, it's meaningful because, you know, putting live performances, you know, it's great. We expect audiences to come and enjoy, but not everybody is maybe aware of the concerts or may not be going to, let's say, a classical concert. That's not, may not be their regular thing, or their parents may not be really interested. So we are able to reach out to those population and those who may be really interested but didn't have an opportunity. And music is fluid. It doesn't have to be one way. The musician can reach out to the audience. So it's not always the audience need to come to the concert. And I like that sort of a portability, and we're sort of equal in that way to share the music. And it could be anywhere. And I think it's wonderful things about music that we can bring it everywhere and share it.
So is there anything about Juneau that you notice that's perhaps a little bit different than other communities? You know, I moved here in December of last year, and I'm amazed at how immersed this community is in the arts, especially, and because of COVID, they're even more immersed.
Yeah, I would have to agree with you, Rhonda. What strikes me, first of all, is that you're having this festival. You're one of the first in the country to come back out of COVID and for a smaller community to embrace it. And it takes a huge amount of effort to have this happen. And then just walking around the city and noticing all the art galleries, all the functions that are going on. In fact, right now, and as they're setting up for the hall, they're having another function between now and the concert tonight. And I've never seen so much activity. I can only imagine pre-COVID what it was like, but it strikes me as unbelievable for a population how much is going on.
Well, I know that you two are very busy because you have a concert to get ready for. So I want to say goodbye for now, but leave with one of your pieces, Helen, and maybe you could cue it up for us. It was the one that I recorded yesterday during your rehearsal. Tell us about it, and then we'll say goodbye.
Great. Thanks, Rhonda. So this is a piece that is new to me. It's a tango. And like Jasmine, I do really love that kind of Spanish flair. And this Astor Piazzolla was the famous Argentinian composer that kind of reinvented the tango, allowed us classically trained musicians to kind of branch out of our comfort zone. And I was looking for solo violin pieces for him, and there was nothing unaccompanied, but I found these flute etudes. There's a group of six, and I kind of made it work for violin, added a few different things. I used to play flute actually really badly, but I tried to play on the flute. I could not do it, but it's just a really fun tango. It has that distinctive Nuevo tango that he brought back, and it's just a joy. We'll be playing this tomorrow at the Putting on the Ritz, and also some of the piano trios from the Four Seasons. So Piazzolla is new to me, actually. I didn't study him when I was a student, when I knew Zuhl. It's something that I kind of came into later in my life. So it's always fun to discover new composers.
Well, I want to thank both of you for being here with us today. Thanks so much. And thank you for coming to Juneau and sharing your art with us.
Thank you so much, Rhonda. Thank you.
Welcome back to Juneau Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. So tonight, when you go out and about on your first Friday rounds, all the more reason to stop in at the Juneau Artists Gallery. And we have with us today Jane Andreen. She's a member artist and secretary of the organization, here to tell us about kind of a one-time thing that happens, a special opportunity to get some of the art at the gallery at a discount. Welcome, Jane. I guess you're pretty excited about tonight.
Thanks, Rhonda. Yes, we're very excited. And this is actually our local appreciation sale, where for the first weekend in October, we always offer a gallery-wide sale, 15% off everything. And that starts today, runs through Sunday. So everything in the gallery is now 15% off. But I really want to emphasize what we are doing is just saying thank you to the people of Juneau who have continued to support us, especially in the last year and a half when things have been such a struggle. But we are still here. We are alive and thriving. And we look forward to being able to thank everybody for their support.
So the artists have been holding each other together during this COVID, and I can't think of a better organization than to be part of a co-op to get that mutual support.
Rhonda, it is fantastic. I've only belonged for not quite 3 years, but as artists, we usually end up doing our artwork as a rule alone. Being able to belong to this community is so fantastic because we support each other, we share ideas and information, we work for the betterment of the whole, and then still have a place and a way to do our individual work and highlight it.
So once again, can you recap for us what we need to know about tonight and this weekend?
Well, we are having our first Friday. Everything went on sale as of this morning. And so anybody who comes in, if you see something you like, it's going to be 15% off. I also want to share that we have just started, just this week, a sale portion of the gallery, which is not going to be just for this weekend, but will be ongoing. And any artist who wants can put some sale items up for that. So people can come in and take a look at what's for sale anytime.
So when you have an event like this, do you think that it's going to really help the artists, you know, that they kind of need that support right now?
Absolutely. And I want to say last year, starting in the fall especially, people were so good about coming in, and they have for the past year and a half, and really supporting us. This year, of course, we had a little bit of a boost, first with the small cruise ships and independent tourists coming in, and then over the last month or two with the larger ships coming in. It has been a nice pace, and it has helped. But we are 100% dependent on local people supporting us to stay in business.
So every time I go in there, I always have my eye on a thing or two, thinking, when can I afford to get that? How about you? Have you got your eye on a few things?
Goodness. Let me tell you, I work about once a week at the gallery, and every time I walk in there, I see something new. I'm just amazed at how prolific the artists are. And yes, I have my eye on a couple of things. I just have to convince my husband we have wall space for a little more art.
And of course, you make jewelry, right?
Yes.
So how do you feel about letting your art go at a hefty discount?
It's absolutely wonderful. Because I like being able to get it out there so that people can see it. It's a really good way to actually advertise the work. I was on a blues cruise once, speaking of the Juneau Jazz and Classics, and a friend from Homer was on the cruise with me, and this woman walked by and she was wearing a pair of my earrings, and I acted like oh, I made those. It was really exciting.
I've seen some of your pieces. They kind of enhance the natural beauty of the stones, you know, the way that you present them. I guess, what do you call that when you wrap metal around them or string them up? The settings.
It's metal. Yeah.
It looks like we may have had a Zoom glitch there. It looks like our connection has frozen, so I apologize for that. But
it's metal work. It's wire wrapping.
Can
you hear me now?
I can hear you now. Sorry about that.
That's okay. The power of Zoom. We have five artists who are making jewelry at this time, five or six. What I really appreciate is we all have a different style and we can support each other in the work we're doing. So there's, I think, something for everyone.
All right. Thank you so much, Jane Andreen. And that'll do it for Juno Afternoon.